And now take your guns and your men and your canoes before we set them on fire and leave Sir Raff's precious lands. Boys, hollered Carrotbeard. Armed and ready. Armed and ready. At this, the men raised their guns again and clustered round Sir Raff and Leon. He lifted up his hands in the manner of a priest about to bestow a blessing and said, Listen to me, good souls. I'm a peace-loving man, and there is harmony on Savage Land. No blood is spilt here. Now, let me tell you that these houses you have occupied are being built as a hospital, and you must leave them. We're not leaving, said another man, in possession of some thick moleskin trousers too wide for his emaciated hips. Not unless you make us. In which case, we'll set them all on fire before we push off. You may be a Raja, but who says you own the ground we're standing on? And we think, from the sound of your voice, that under all that fancy dress, you're just an Englishman, a loyal servant of the Queen. And you know what Australians do to loyal servants of the Queen? We truss them up in their flag and boil them alive. This was followed by laughter and cheering. And before the Raja or Leon could speak, a third man stepped forward and said, We recognize no ownership of lands. We're citizens of the world, and we have as much right to dig for gold wherever it's hiding itself as you have to wear that golden topknot. So you go back to your palace, Raja, Excellency, and let us be. Now there was more cheering and raising of fists, and a shot was fired into the air, causing the Chinese workers to creep away into the shadows of the forest. When he heard the shot, Leon let drop Carrotbeard's wrist, and the yellow mat drifted down onto the river strand. But before he could stoop to retrieve it, Leon's foot had ground it into the dark mud. This so enraged Carrotbeard, who had carried the map next to his heart across fathoms of oceans and miles of river, that he lunged at Leon and knocked him to the ground. In this instant, Sir Raff understood that the woeful invasion could not, at this moment, be resisted either by words or by the display of power residing in his fancy dress. Staining his white robe in the mud, he reached down and helped Leon to his feet. His lover had been hit in the eye and seemed unable to speak. The Raja knew that he must be in excruciating pain, but he would die rather than reveal his suffering. Now Tamina, who had been watching everything from a safe distance, came to her son's side. Ay-ya, ay-ya, she began crying, trying to put her arms around Leon. Ay-ya, ay-ya. And one of the miners called out, That's it, old lady. Take your baby home. The Raja retreated to his house and sat in the grandest of his parlors and looked about him at the objects of value he'd amassed and imagined the gold miners crowding in, stinking of sweat and mud, and helping themselves to his treasures and carrying them away. There would be raucous laughter as golden candelabra were broken like beech twigs and handed out like plugs of tobacco, rising currents of sniggering as a Ming vase was used as a pissoir. For the Raja had understood these citizens of the world had no more respect for man-made boundaries than did the forest. They felt that the succeeding seasons had ravaged them as harshly as they had tormented the trees. They were sticks of men. They tried to put down roots wherever the wind pushed them in their scarred hopes. Their own survival was all that counted. It was this world of hungry, clamoring people which the Raja had fled when he decided to build his palace in the forest. If he knew that only his money and the authority bestowed upon him by a distant sultan had made him master of his little kingdom, he had also sincerely believed that he would rule over a peaceable, thriving community united in quietness and in love for their Raja. And Leon's tantrums aside, the years had passed without terror or catastrophe. He had truly believed that he was regarded as a benign ruler. As for his beloved garden, it had flourished to the point where the colors and scents of the flowers were of such intoxicating sweetness that Tamina had once fainted in a bed of lilies. Now all was under threat. If gold was found, word would travel by canoe along the river, and then more and more boats would come crowding in, bringing more and more desperate men. It wasn't difficult to imagine them cutting down the forest, setting fires, spreading out from clearing to clearing until they arrived within sight of the Raja's lawns. And it was then, Sir Ralph supposed, that they would decide upon their mission to strip the spoiled Raja of his treasures. And perhaps they would not stop at the treasures. For why should one white man inhabit so many rooms when they were living in shacks made of bamboo and palm leaf thatch? But again, why should they stop when they had taken possession of every room in the house? They would not stop. For the idea of torturing an Englishman who wore gold turbans on his head, whose squat little queen pretended to rule over half the world, including their beloved Australia, would then begin to take root in their collective mind. Leon would not be able to save him, nor his servants. The gold secrets would truss up the Raja like an animal. They would take turns at relieving themselves in various ways upon or in his naked person. And then they would put a bullet through his heart. Chapter 50. Leon's Plan. The pain in Leon's eye, great though it was, didn't dismay him quite as much as the temporary loss of his beauty. When he looked at himself now, discovering the shiny purple swellings on his face, he decided that he looked like an insect, and he couldn't bear to let himself be seen, except by his mother. Jimena stayed in his room with him, sleeping on a mat, bringing him food and water and arak, letting him rage by banging his fist against the wall. When the Raja came to his door, he told Jimena not to let him in. Leon felt that his terrible resemblance to a fly would take from him all his sexual power over Sir Ralph, and he was not prepared to let this happen. So the two men stayed apart, both haunted by the arrival of the miners, both trying to work out how the usurpers might be sent away, and neither of them finding a solution to something they had never predicted. If Leon let himself imagine different ways of killing them, these reveries soon enough fell apart. From their very appearance, Leon could tell that the gold diggers were anxious, watchful people, used to a life where danger always lurked, where vigilance was second nature to them. To kill one man, an element of surprise was needed. To kill a group of nervous, armed desperados, much more than this was required. There would need to be a plan. The plan soon enough formed in his mind, as he knew it would. By his nature and by his cunning, he was a man who found solutions to problems which eluded others. When the swelling on his face had subsided a little, he tied a silk scarf around his head and around his wounded eye and rode to Kuching. He chose the best of the Raja's horses, and the exertions of the ride put Leon into a strangely euphoric frame of mind. Though the sun burned down upon him and the dust cast up from the narrow highway threatened to choke him, he saw himself as he always longed to be seen, a man traveling through the world at capricious speed, ignoring danger, a brave and undaunted man who would overcome whatever adversity life placed in his path. He refused to think about his failures. He'd believed in his fish cannery, and he knew he'd designed good housing for the factory he'd seen in his mind. It had not been his fault that the British engineer had been such a trembling fool. And now, though his plan for a hospital was also threatened, he believed he'd seen how he could save it. Urging his stallion to an ever faster gallop, he arrived soon enough at Kuching. He dismounted and led the sweating horse through the bazaar which overlooked the Sarawak River. He had silver in a purse concealed round his waist. He passed a stall selling baby parrots in cages and noticed that the little birds were all huddled in one far corner of their prisons, with their backs turned to those who passed by. And he thought, this is how human life must be led if a man does not assert himself. He has to crouch in a dark place with his face turned away from the world. But that man will never be me. He went on past flower stalls and furniture menders and rice sellers, and stopped at last at a stall selling knives and daggers. Leon was not fond of guns, but he was seldom without his own crease, and had, over 37 years of his life, let his worship of the shining blade develop into something almost mystical. He'd never cut a man's flesh, but something in him was enthralled by the idea of doing so. The cleanness of the act, skin and flesh, parting obediently in one magnificent downward thrust of his hand, letting flow a great fountain of blood, made him tremble with excitement. And here, at the modest stall, his practiced eye fell upon one dagger which he longed to possess. He lifted it up, admiring its handle jeweled with lapis lazuli, and liking the weight of it, the kind of weight which had been perfectly judged for what a man's arm could be comfortable with, at the same time revealing to him the extreme damage the blade could inflict. Though the dagger was expensive, and might mean that he would not be able to pay for more than one boy for the sexual release he now badly needed, Leon felt that he had to buy it. When he told the stallholder that he would take it for a price not much less than the one being asked, the man looked at him and said, "You are wise in your purchase, sir. This dagger has great power, but you must talk to it."
"Talk to the dagger?"
"You must tell it the names of those you wish to harm, and then it will do your work." Leon stared at the beautiful blue of the lapis. He knew only one man whose eyes were of this otherworldly color. To put his plan for getting rid of the Australian miners into action, Leon knew he would have to spend a night, or more than one, in Kuching. After finding a stall selling dumplings and filling his belly with these, and drinking two cups of Tuak, he made his way to one of the dilapidated houses where his boys led a twilight life in rooms piled high with stained mats and where incense burned night and day to keep insects away and to mask the smell of stale semen, which was an aphrodisiac to some men and to others a terrible killer of desire. Leon had a favorite boy here, a young Chinese by the name of Chang. Chang's skin was very soft, like the skin of a woman. He barely spoke, but just offered himself straight away, kneeling with thighs apart, in just the position Leon liked. Leon undressed quickly. The purchase of the dagger and the terrible thought of how he might one day use it had put him into a painful state of arousal, and the rapid mounting of Chang was sweeter and more potent than it had ever been. When it was over, he surprised himself by taking Chang into his arms and kissing him. Afterwards, they sat side by side on a pile of mats and smoked. And as Leon watched the blue smoke curl and billow about the small room, he knew that the time had come to put his plan into action. He began asking Chang about the rumors of fever in the city, and Chang told him that here, by the Sarawak River, you could hardly smell the maltapest, but that if you went into the center of Kuching, you began to breathe it and taste it, the deadly miasma that brought sickness and death from dengue fever. Some people, he said, had already fallen ill, and many were trying to get passage on a boat to Singapore. "Where will I find those who are suffering?" asked Leon. "I need to find two or three who are stricken down."
"Why do you need two or three who are stricken down?" asked Chang.
"Because," said Leon, "I'm going to save them. This is my mission, to take them away from Kuching. Perhaps I cannot save them. Perhaps they are too far gone in the fever, in which case they will die. But I'm going to try and make them well. And what I must do for this is take them to another place."
"Where is this other place?" asked Chang.
Leon kept drawing smoke into his lungs and savoring its release as he described to Chang how he had built a hospital in the forest. But the hospital had been invaded by men from a faraway country, who were not stricken in any way except by a lust for gold, and who were about to rape the land and destroy acres of forest with their foul and greedy diggings. "At first," said Leon, "I could not see how I was going to persuade them to leave. I thought that I would have to try to kill them, but it is beyond me to kill so many. And then I saw how, if I brought in the sick and dying to my hospital, if I brought there the people for whom my hospital was designed, then these foreign men would be filled with terror. And what would they do? They are poor men whose hopes have been disappointed too many times to count, and they may be reluctant to abandon what they think will be the source of their fortunes. But soon enough they will go. They would rather live with their disappointment than die, for who would not? So eventually they will get back in their boats with all their cargo, and they will sail away down the Sadong River, and we will never see them again." Chang was silent. He looked into Leon's face, still half concealed by the silk bandage. Then he said, "Who will care for the stricken and the dying?"
My mother will care for them, replied Leon. I will pay her with silver and with objects that I have been given by the Raja. She will care for them for a little while, and then they may die. Indeed, they will almost certainly die in due time. We will send their bodies down the river and imagine them arriving at the sea. And then we will be at peace once more. Chapter 51. Lilies and Briars. If Jane wondered at how often she succumbed to great tides of weeping in the wake of Emmeline's death, she also reminded herself that pregnant women were said to become emotionally fragile in the early months of carrying a child. She knew, too, that she wept for her future. To become the wife of Valentine Ross now seemed to her like entering the portals of hell. The engagement would have to be broken off before Ross learned of her pregnancy. And after that, she would never see him again. But what would then become of her? She feared some violent anger in Ross which might destroy her. But not only that, she knew that society liked to turn its back on unmarried mothers, even perhaps the bohemian, emancipated portion of society which had clustered around her Aunt Emmeline. And so she would be quite alone. And her child would grow up to be alone and friendless. And all because it had interested her, for a brief moment, to know what making love with a man was like. Now she cursed her own foolish curiosity and her physical greed. If only she'd not done that, then a bright future might have awaited her. She would have been able to make whatever she chose of a life in London. Close to Julietta, a life of wondrous freedom. Perhaps she could have started her own clinic in Tite Street, or perhaps again some new direction could have been found, some gradual discovery of the thing which she'd always believed attended her somewhere along the pathway of her life. But nothing of the kind would be possible now. To her diary, she confided, "Either I will become the unhappy wife of Valentine Ross, or I will be an outcast woman, trying my best to love and shelter a child. I see us now, the two of us, myself and a little girl, who already begins to grow tall like her mother. Together we wander Emmeline's high rooms, unvisited. We are waiting only for the years to pass." Ross bombarded Jane daily with letters, asking forgiveness for his ill-considered outburst in the offices of Dutton and Caldecott, and begging her to return to Bath. But she would not go. She replied that she was trying to assemble a beautiful service of farewell for Aunt Emily, and that until this was over, she would remain in London. At Tite Street, on the days before the funeral, Jane received many callers, offering their affection and condolences. Among these were Emmeline's picture framers, Mr. Hartley and Mr. Fulkes. They had brought with them the portrait of Jane, which had served as a stretcher to convey Emmeline to the doctor. It was now framed in ebony, Emmeline's emphatic choice, and to Jane's eyes it appeared fractionally altered, as though the subject in her white gown had aged a little during the intervening time when the frame was made. Hartley and Fulkes propped up the portrait in the hall, and they both looked from it to Miss Jane, now robed in black, and nodded their approval.
"If I may say," said Mr. Hartley, "a very successful likeness."
"And I notice another thing," said Mr. Fulkes, "a likeness not just between portrait and subject, but a striking family resemblance between Miss Adine and the late Miss Adine."
If Jane knew that this was flattery, that Emmeline had in her youth been a great beauty, while Jane, with her extraordinary height, was merely considered to be handsome, she was nevertheless gladdened by it. Anything which bound her retrospectively to Emmeline consoled her, and she thanked Mr. Fulkes and asked if he and Mr. Hartley would like to take a glass of sherry with her while payment for the ebony frame could be handed over.
"Payment?" said Mr. Hartley.
"Oh no, my dear madam. Mr. Fulkes and I are absolutely agreed. We would like to offer the frame to you as a gift to the late Miss Adine, as a mark of our respect and appreciation. She trusted our humble firm with her work for many years, and we wish you to know how much we valued this."
Jane regarded the two men, who were both now advancing in years and both a little stooped from the hours they spent at the framing table. And she thought how, here and there in the world, often hidden away in some alley or winding street which few people ever trod. There were small yet wonderful oases of human dedication and kindness of spirit. And this gladdened her most particularly because she had seen it and not allowed it to pass her by. Hartley and Fulks courteously declined the offer of sherry and were in the very act of replacing their top hats on their balding heads and making for the front door when Jane turned again to look at the portrait and came to a decision which surprised her. She asked the framers if they might be able to hang the picture there, where it stood in the hall, the first thing visitors to the house would see as they came in.
"Ah," said Mr. Hartley, "an excellent choice of location. The late Miss O'Dean would have approved, I know. Do you have the necessary, Fulks?"
"I have it," said Fulks,
and opened his frock coat to reveal a slim canvas bag attached to his waist, from which he produced a tape measure, a length of wire, and numerous nails of varying sizes and conditions of rust. So the portrait was hung in what Jane knew to be an ostentatious place, but she also knew why she had put it in the hall. The picture was the one thing shared completely between her and her aunt, each dependent on the other to bring it into the world, and both of them united in the secret of the golem, and so bound her to the idea that she had inherited the house by right, and only those who could bear to look at her portrait and walk by it without disdain would be allowed to enter there. If Ross wanted to believe that he was punishing Jane by disdaining to attend Emmeline Dean's funeral, he also knew he was deluding himself. He was not there because Jane had not deigned to invite him. He sat in his rooms in Edgar's Buildings, fighting dark feelings of intense hurt and anger. He said aloud to the peeling wallpaper of his sitting room, "This cannot go on." Jane, meanwhile, was grateful that he was not beside her in the church. While the scented air was filled with passionate singing and Sir William gave heartfelt oration on the great and generous spirit of my sister, Jane sat between Julietta and Clorinda Morrissey, and both of them held on to her and let her cry. Ashton Sims, sitting just behind them, now and then reached out a comforting black-gloved hand and laid it tenderly on Jane's shoulder. On the coffin, Jane had suggested a large spray of lilies expensively imported from Southern Europe should be placed, but she'd also gone out into Emmeline's untidy garden and cut branches of bramble and asked the florist to arrange these among the lilies, explaining to him that her aunt had been, on the one hand, as serene and beautiful as a lily, but that she'd only been able to persevere as an artist in a man's world by being brave enough to display her thorns from time to time. If the florist was tempted to protest that he might scratch his delicate fingers with the wretched briars, he did not do so, and when the arrangement was complete and laid on the casket, he prided himself that it was strangely pleasing and more original than any funeral spray he had ever seen. Respecting Emmeline's taste, Jane ordered ballotine of chicken with pickled radishes and champagne to be served to the funeral guests at Tite Street. She walked slowly among them, her weeping now held in check by her sipping of her favorite drink, and was surprised and pleased to note that Ashton Sims had brought Guy Molinet with him, the French author being in London for the launch of the English edition of his novel Morgue.
"Forgive my uninvited presence," Molinet had said to Jane, "but as you know, all that pertains to death is of passionate interest to me. Ashton thought I might be moved by the English way of saying goodbye."
"You are welcome here, Monsieur Molinet. Is the ballotine to your liking, or do they make it much better in Paris?"
"Oh, it is very good for London."
"Oh, for London. Yes, I do see. And you were moved by the church service?"
"I thought the singing was quite fine, and I much liked the briars on the coffin. I suppose this is an English convention, is it, to remind us that life's road is difficult?"
"No," said Jane. "It was just something I felt was right for my aunt. The arrangements all fell to me, for it seems that Emmeline has left me almost everything she had."
Molinet's eyes widened at this. "Everything she had," he said. "So you are now the owner of this house?"
"Yes, I am," said Jane. "Except I feel that it will always belong to Emmeline, and I will just be its guardian until she decides to return." As she said this, Jane once more felt her eyes fill with tears. Molyneux reached out and laid his hand on her arm.
My dear Mademoiselle Jane, he said, may I say that I find you an exceptional woman. But listen to me. Why do you and Julietta not come to Paris for a while? A change of city may help you recover from your loss. I can introduce you to many artistic friends, writers and poets.
At this moment, Julietta, seeing Jane overcome once more, appeared at her side and held her close, putting her dark head on Jane's shoulder. Molyneux laid upon the sight a surreptitious smile, not entirely unmixed with yearning. If few Englishmen could have guessed that Jane and Julietta were lovers, or let such an outrageous supposition even enter their minds, it seemed to the Frenchman entirely believable and probable that they were, and he found this thought most marvelously arousing. A vision of the two women, the petite and beautiful Italian, the tall and handsome English girl, together in bed, with him as well, bien sûr, flitted across his mind in wildly gyrating colors.
I was saying to Mademoiselle Jane, he said, I do believe that you two should come to Paris again for a long sojour. What do you think, Signora Sims?
Julietta looked up at Jane. She was about to say to Molyneux that Jane was engaged to be married and would soon have to return to Bath, but Jane's challenging expression seemed to beg her to keep quiet on the subject, so she did not say this. Instead, she smiled at Molyneux and said, I think we will both find that very tempting, wouldn't we, Jane? Jane nodded. She was speechless, because she had begun to wonder on the instant if, in some way that she couldn't yet define, an escape to France might not resolve her terrible predicament. There is only the question of Marco, continued Julietta, glancing across the room at Ashton. I couldn't bear to be separated from Marco for very long.
Naturally not, said Guy Molyneux. We can find you a large apartment, perhaps on one of Haussmann's new boulevards, and there will be room for Marco and his nanny. We will teach him French. We will take him to the carousel in the Tuileries.
He is very fond of his rocking horse, who has a French name. Trebuchet.
Trebuchet? How excellent. Is he a war horse?
I don't know. I believe Marco may think he is.
Then of course he must come too. What could be easier than shipping an English war horse to France?
Chapter 52. Something of Great Weight. When the funeral guests had left, all except Sir William and Clorinda Morrissey, the subject of their marriage came gently to the surface, and Sir William said,
We hope you will not take it as any insult to Emmeline, Jane, if we now set a date in early September.
No, said Jane. Of course not. Emmeline would have wanted you to be married, and I am so much looking forward to your wedding. And Father, I have been thinking. Emmeline has left me some very fine jewelry, and I would love Clorinda to choose a beautiful piece as my wedding gift to her.
Oh, jewelry! Good heavens above, said Clorinda. No, indeed, that must all stay with you, Jane. I couldn't think of taking it.
But I will be so sad if you don't. There is far more than I will ever wear. Why do we not leave Father to fall asleep by the fire and we can go look at it at least?
I truly cannot take jewelry from you, protested Clorinda.
But Jane laid a gentle finger on Mrs. Morrissey's mouth to silence her, and Sir William said,
I advise that you do as she suggests, Clorinda, for you know how vexed Jane can become if her commands are not followed.
So the two women went up to Jane's room, and she tugged from under her bed a large wooden jewel box. She set it on the floor, and they knelt down beside it. Once the lid was opened, it was possible to pull out two little drawers, delicately hinged in brass and inlaid with black velvet. On the velvet rested a quantity of gems of every form and color, and Clorinda let out a gasp of wonder as the collection was revealed.
You see, said Jane, what a surfeit there is. How my aunt came by all this, I'm not entirely certain. But I know she had a weakness for sapphires, as you can see. Perhaps she could not pass a shop in Piccadilly without buying a sapphire, as other people buy candied fruit. Perhaps she paid the jewelers with portraits of their wives and children. But now tell me what pleases you.
Jane picked up a sapphire necklace and held it against Clorinda's white neck. "What about this?" she said. "Or is blue the wrong color for your wedding dress?" "Well," stammered Clorinda, "I had my eye on green and cream silk." "Emeralds, then," said Jane. "There is no emerald necklace, but what about this brooch? Emeralds and diamonds, would that not be perfect for you? Or would rubies look very fine against the green and cream silk?" At the mention of rubies, Clorinda found herself blushing an embarrassing red and put a hand to her face to hide it. As soon as the box had been opened, her eye had alighted on a double-stranded ruby bracelet which had flooded her mind with temptation, but she knew that she should not even touch it. She fancied that if she laid her hand on it, there would occur some terrible, painful burning. "To tell you the truth," said Clorinda, "I'm not very fond of rubies."
"No, I believe I'm not either," said Jane. "Perhaps it is their affinity with blood, is it? I think I will have to give them to Julietta, or perhaps just drop them down some convenient Chelsea drain. But do you like the emerald brooch?"
"It's beautiful. I like it very well, but..."
"But what?"
"I just don't feel that it's right to take your jewelry."
"It's not mine, just as the house is not really mine. All of this was Emmeline's, and she looked to find custodians of it after she was gone."
"Nevertheless..."
"Are you refusing to be one of Emmeline's custodians?"
No, I wouldn't put it like that."
Jane held out the emerald brooch in the palm of her hand. Even in the soft lamplight of her room, the stones radiated magnificence.
"Listen, Clorinda, you who are about to become my dear stepmother, would you do me the great favor of taking the brooch if I ask you something in return?"
"Something in return?"
"Something of great weight, a weight that you might not be able to bear."
Seeing the sudden alarm on Clorinda's face, Jane reached out and pinned the emerald brooch to Clorinda's dress and said,
"The brooch is heavy. See how it pulls a little at the fabric of your bodice? Am I asking too much of you to suffer the same kind of tug?"
"No," said Clorinda, "I'm sure you are not."
"And can you promise to keep secret from everybody in the world, including my father for the time being, what I am about to tell you?"
"Yes," said Clorinda, but the word came out strangely, seeming to cause the normally serene Mrs. Morrissey a sudden moment of dyspepsia. Jane waited until this appeared to be past and then said,
"Well, I have made an important decision."
"Yes?"
"I know that it's unfair of me to burden you with this. It is, I suppose, that I trust you absolutely."
"You are right to trust me, Jane. I promise I will keep anything you tell me safely stowed away inside me."
"Well, the death of my aunt has made me see the world in a new way. And I realize that I have made a great mistake in agreeing to marry Valentine Ross."
"A mistake? Are you telling me?"
"Yes. I know now that such a marriage would make me intolerably unhappy, and I have decided that I cannot go through with it."
Clorinda was silent. Her hand clutched at the brooch pinned to her dress, and she stared at Jane in frank amazement.
"I see," she said at last. "Of course Valentine will be angry, and my father will be upset, but I cannot help it, Clorinda. What I see in such a marriage is a desert of misery."
"In that case, of course, you're right to call it off. These things are absolutes, and if we make the wrong choice..."
"It is in my mind to go live in Paris for a while."
"Paris?"
"Yes. They are laying out a new city some people are calling the City of Light. It will be very beautiful, and this is what I ask of my life, that it be new and beautiful."
"Indeed. All lives should have some beauty about them. But love is the thing of greatest beauty, Jane. Do you really not love Dr. Ross?"
"No," said Jane. "I have tried to love him. For a while I thought I could, but now I feel that I do not even like him."
Clorinda Morrissey was silent for a moment more, and then she said, "I cannot help but remember the day, soon after I opened my tea rooms, when you arrived a little late, and Dr. Ross was all of an agitation waiting for you. And then you got up and went away with your cake uneaten. And I could see,
even from a distance, that Dr. Ross was very unhappy.
Yes, he proposed to me that day and I turned him down. And it should all have been left like that, in a state where nothing more was possible between us.
But while you and my father were in Dublin, I went to his bed.
You went to his bed?
Yes. You're not shocked, are you, Clorinda?
No, no. Things of that kind have never shocked me.
He made love to me, but I didn't enjoy it. Hardly at all. I know we are meant to enjoy this ritual, but I did not. Yet after that, there did not seem to be any way of distancing myself from the idea of marriage. I am to blame in this, Clorinda. I am to blame.
Seeing that Jane might be about to start weeping again, Clorinda reached out and held her tightly. If she struggled to think of words to comfort her, it was only because she felt afraid. Perhaps nobody knew better than she, whose eye was so accurately attuned to the joys and sorrows of her tea-room clientele, how desperate was Ross's longing to make a life with Jane. What he would do now that he was to be sent back to a solitary existence without her, Clorinda could not predict. But the certainty that something ugly would occur clutched at her heart.
What we must do, said Clorinda at last, is to try to protect you from Dr. Ross's anger. What I suggest, dear Jane, is that you leave for Paris as soon as you can and that you write to him from there to tell him of your decision, but do not send your address. Would your friend Julietta be able to arrange matters in France?
Yes, said Jane, but it will take a little time. Somewhere for us to live must be found, and I have more business to attend to on behalf of Emmeline's legatees and papers to sign for the house.
So when were you planning on telling the poor man?
I don't know, Clorinda. All I knew until today was that I had to tell someone, and I'm sorry for your sake that I chose you. But now that I've burdened you with news so heavy, please say you will accept the brooch.
Clorinda again touched the beautiful jewel, and the thought that it was an emerald and so contained within it the spirit of her Irish homeland moved her to say that she would accept it and treasure it forever. This in turn emboldened Jane to say, "There is just one more thing, Clorinda. I discovered this emerald and diamond ring on my dressing table. I'm not sure how it found its way there. Perhaps it was dropped and Nancy found it on the floor and put it there, thinking it was mine. But when I put it into the jewel box, I saw that it appeared to be all of a piece with the brooch. So here, please take the ring as well. If we hold it against the brooch, look. We can see that the cut and the color of the emeralds are almost identical. They should not be separated."
Chapter 53, The Wooden Hoop. On the day that Clorinda Morrissey and Sir William returned to Bath, something happened to Valentine Ross which had never happened before. One of his patients drowned in the hot bath. The nurse assisting him and Sir William in Jane's absence, who styled herself Nurse Marion, had accompanied the elderly woman, who was suffering from body tremors, the cause of which Ross was unable to diagnose, to the healing waters. Nurse Marion was the kind of sharp-nosed person who wished to give the impression of stern dedication to her calling, but who was addicted to the habit of making notes in minuscule, neat writing upon everything that happened in the surgery, and was so often distracted from actually observing the patients or listening carefully to what they had to say. This, together with the baleful fact that she overstarched her aprons and so walked about the premises crackling like a rasher of frying bacon, made Ross suspect that her time at Henrietta Street would have to be limited. Now, when he heard about the death of his patient who had slipped so silently under the green waters that nobody noticed, he was dismayed on two counts. That the patient had died for nothing but want of vigilance on behalf of Nurse Marion, and that the whole sorry business had happened because Jane had deserted her duties, both as his fiancée and as his medical assistant. Indeed, he felt that not only this, but everything that might go wrong in his professional life from now on was Jane's fault. She was selfish and proud. If she was an angel, then surely she was also a witch. People could fall under her spell and be cursed. Death could occur, and nobody was at greater risk from her maledictions than he was. These thoughts brought about in him the certainty that he would have to act. He couldn't remain patiently in Bath while Miss Jane drew out her mourning for her aunt for as long as it suited her,
And more importantly, he wished to know, once and for all, if Jane was deceiving him, either with some dilettante bohemian lover or, and this thought caused him the greater amount of anger and repulsion, by going against nature and finding erotic satisfaction with her friend Giulietta. As yet, he had no absolute proof of anything, but the tableau he'd seen in the Tite Street drawing room kept reappearing in his mind. Giulietta's head on Jane's lap, an attitude of abandonment in both the women's bodies. The picture would not leave him, and he felt that he'd endured these terrible suspicions long enough. He had to find out the truth, no matter what the consequences would prove to be. When he announced to Sir William and Mrs. Morrissey that he had decided to go to London with the intention of persuading Jane to come back to Bath and resume her rightful duties, he saw on Clorinda Morrissey's face a look of sudden and unmistakable panic.
"What is it?" he asked.
"Oh, no," said Mrs. Morrissey. "Nothing at all, Dr. Ross. It's only that Jane mentioned to me that she had much paperwork to be concluded with the solicitors overseeing Miss Emmeline's legacies and so forth."
"Well, in that case," said Ross, "I can be of assistance, perhaps. It is my opinion that women have a very poor and inadequate understanding of legal business. Their minds are unable to follow the logic of the subordinate clause."
"Speaking as a businesswoman, I would not agree with you there," said Clorinda, and Sir William appeared to nod his concurrence. "But in all events, I think, if I might venture to say, Jane will come back to Bath when she's ready to come back. And it would be wise of you—"
"You are about to say that I should leave her alone. But I don't think you understand my position. In a few months' time, Jane will become my wife. My wife. She is 25 and has had admirers, but no suitors of any seriousness. Therefore, I do her honor in marrying her. She must learn to get used to obeying me, at least from time to time."
Sir William then drew Ross aside. In gentle tones, he said,
"I understand how you feel. The death of Emmeline has been difficult for us all, but let me remind you that Jane has always done things in her own way and in her own time. That may have something to do with the fact that you've always spoiled and indulged her, sir. But are you saying that this can be allowed to continue for the rest of our lives? I'm to stand by while she behaves exactly as she pleases?" "Well," said Sir William, "I would not phrase it like that, but you have known Jane for many years. You know what kind of woman you are marrying. Do you really imagine that she's going to change?"
"Yes," said Ross, "because I wish it. Because unless she does..."
"Well, what are you saying?"
"I do not know," said Ross with a sigh. "I do not know. But I think that if she does not, then both she and I will suffer."
When Valentine Ross arrived at Tite Street, he was told by the maid Nancy that Miss Jane was sleeping and could not be disturbed. It was early afternoon. After ordering Nancy to bring him a bowl of coffee, Ross walked back into the hall and stared up at the portrait. He thought it conceited of Jane, vulgar even, to have placed this large image of herself so near to the front door. From the picture, she looked down at him with the ghost of a smile on her lips, and he had to admit that Emmeline had indeed captured the essence of Jane. The power in her body, the challenge in her eyes, and then this tremble on the edge of laughter about her mouth, this inability to resist teasing and mockery. But for all its accuracy, or perhaps because of it, he did not love the portrait. He especially did not like the object she held in her hands, a little, ugly mannequin, and he couldn't imagine why Jane had agreed to be pictured with this. He decided that if he was going to live with Jane as his wife in Tite Street, the vexing portrait would have to be hidden somewhere out of sight. He looked at his watch, then consulted the long case clock in the hall. It was almost 3 o'clock. At this hour in Bath, Jane would always be with her patients, and it surprised him that she should be sleeping. He reasoned that perhaps her grief for Emmeline had exhausted her, but then it evaded him like a wave of sickness, the sudden certainty that she was not sleeping at all. She was with Giulietta. He couldn't move. If he thought of walking out of the house to protect himself from seeing what he knew he would not be able to bear, he dismissed this only as a prolongation of his agony. Instead, he turned at once and began running up the stairs. He knew his way now to Jane's room. He did not go in, but stood outside listening. At first he could hear nothing, and for a second dared to hope that he had been wrong and that Jane was asleep after all. But then they came, the unmistakable sounds of sexual exertion, accompanied by breathless murmurations and followed by a little passionate cry. It was a woman's cry, and the name she kept repeating in her ecstasy was Jane's. Ross's hand was on the door handle, and he was a second away from turning it and opening the portal on the scene which had tortured him for what now seemed like some terrible eternity. But he knew that his agony was such that he would not be able to control himself. He would scream until his lungs burst, and then he would hurt Jane. He would have to hurt her. Violence was all that was left to him. He ran back down the stairs at a headlong pitch, like a boy running for his life. In the hall, he collided with Nancy bringing the coffee. The bowl fell from the tray and smashed, and the hot coffee spread steaming over the marble floor. Nancy's legs were scalded, and she cried out in pain, but Ross paid this no heed. He rushed into the drawing room. He stood still for a moment, wondering what would serve him best in his intent, then snatched up the poker from the hearth. Now he was standing in front of the portrait again, but this time he had a weapon in his hands. He later recalled wishing that the weapon was a knife so that he could slash and slice at the canvas, but the poker was satisfactorily heavy, and with it he began hitting the painting with as much force as he could summon. He was not aiming at Jane's face, but at the lower part of her body, dressed in its lying, virginal white gown, just below the place where her hands cradled the ridiculous mannequin. And little by little, Jane's gown was rent and torn, and what Ross expected to see was her naked torso revealed in all its beauty and in all its shame. But the body did not appear. He kept smashing harder and harder with the poker at the canvas, but there was nothing behind the gown except a square of wall, and when he saw this, Ross thought that this wall was a perfect representation of Jane Adine's heart, so terrifying in its hardness, which had never yielded to him and never would. He began cursing Jane out loud, screaming that she was inhuman, that the abomination in her hands had been given more love than he would ever receive from her, and that he hated her now, hated her with a loathing so strong that it would never leave him. He might live to be 100 years old, but his detestation of Jane Adine would last that 100 years and beyond. Suddenly she was at his side. She was crying out for him to stop his assault on the portrait. He saw her close up, now her hair unkempt, her face oily, her eyes pools of venom, and the stink of her. As long as he lived, he would never forget that fish smell of his once beloved woman caught in the act of her foul betrayal. He thrust her away from him, letting the poker fall. He pushed her against the wall. She was strong and she resisted him, but he told her she could not win against him. She could never win, for everything was at an end now. His loathing of her was complete. There would be no marriage. There would be no future. There would only be this last moment. He tugged her towards him, then pushed her violently back so that her head hit the wall. In his delirium of pain and anger, he half expected the skull to break in two, but it did not break, and Jane kept crying out and resisting and resisting, but he knew he could not allow this unbearable resistance. It had to be put down once and for all. So he pulled her towards him for a second time. Once more he rammed her head against the wall, and now he felt her fall. All the resistance went from her, and she lay unconscious at his feet, with blood seeping from the back of her head. And he thought, this is what I've wanted. Ever since that day in the tea room when she rejected my proposal, I have wanted her lying before me, helpless and at my mercy, and now there she lies. Perhaps he was about to kick out at her, kick her like the filthy animal she was, but then he felt himself being pulled away from her. The woman's stink was still there, but he realized now that two other women had grabbed his arms, Julietta and the maid. He tried to wrench himself from their grip, but he was outnumbered. He was back to being the plaything of women, their toy, their fool, and all he could do was to keep cursing at the top of his voice. Resisting all the while, he was dragged outside onto the steps. The steps were slippery in the rain that was now falling, and he knew in the next moment he would fall too. Juliet and the maid pushed him down the steps and into the street, and he lay there with his left leg twisted under him, staring up at the front door, which was now slammed shut. In the next moment, a child came skipping by, bowling a wooden hoop. The hoop's steadiness and momentum was such that when its passage was blocked by the body of Valentine Ross, it lifted itself up and bounced over his anguished face and sped on. Part 4. Chapter 54. A Bargain. The Australian miners had tried everything they knew. Most of them were old hands, connoisseurs in the art of gold seeking and proud of it. They had been told that the Borneo mine was exhausted, but they knew that if anyone could find the tailings that remained, it would be them. Slabs of black beech had been carefully laid in to prevent their diggings from collapse. They had broken their backs carting soil away to the river. They had manufactured box flumes to bring water to their claims for sifting the dirt through their sluice boxes. When rats started to appear, feasting off decayed food and human excrement, they had killed as many as they could and roasted them. They referred to them as ground squirrels and declared that they remembered the delicate flavor of their flesh from the old Otago days. They knew enough to dig deeply to where the blue clay lay. Sometimes alluvial gold was to be found at the river's edge, but these workings were some way from the river, and the true seams lay in depths that were hard to reach. Here, on Borneo, the blue was stubborn. It just wouldn't show itself. Each evening at dusk, as Carrotbeard and his fellow diggers trudged back to where they'd placed some of their group to guard their longhouses, they swore at another day lost, at another postponement of the dream which transfixed their minds. As time passed, they faced a new threat to their hopes. In the largest of the longhouses, Malay women began to arrive, bringing with them sick and dying people, and laying them down among the miners' possessions, leaving the diggers who had made their billet there no choice but to take up their sleeping mats and move. Carrotbeard, whose name was Jim Mackenzie, berated the guards. "Women and invalids," he shouted at them. "Are you telling me they overpowered you?" They had no answer to this, but one of them asked, "Is that who we are? People who shoot women? Who murder those who can't lift up their heads?" And the miner's leader was checked by this response and didn't know what to say. He wondered if his desire for mastery of the situation, his longing to replace his own hard life with the easeful old age which gold would buy, had made him more heartless than he knew. He made his way to the hospital, taking care to fill his pockets with bullets for his gun. But when he went into the longhouse, the stench of it made him reel back. He stood in the doorway regarding the scene. The place wasn't yet crowded, but from the palliasses where the sick lay struggling with the ravages to their bodies came a low and terrible human cry which froze Mackenzie's blood. Among the sufferers, who numbered 8 or 9, two Malay women with scarves wrapped around their faces were working as nurses, offering medicine and swabbing the vomit-stained floor. When they saw the Australian gold seeker at the door, they barely glanced at him, but lowered their eyes and continued with their work. To find himself disregarded in this way troubled Mackenzie almost as much as the sight and stench of the dying. He was a forceful and fearless man, used to being respected for his hardness, but what he saw here were people who had passed into a different realm of existence, where nothing signified except the struggle with death. He suspected that, were he to raise his gun and point it into the room, the nurses would take little notice of this, but merely see his actions as futile. It was then that he began to feel afraid. He and his fellow miners had gambled much and traveled far on the wings of rumor. They had let themselves believe that there were fortunes to be made from the Sarawak mine, but as yet had found not 1 ounce of gold. And now, not only did they seem to be tiring themselves out for nothing, they were at risk from a contagion which could end their lives. Against most enemies, they had their courage, their weapons, their knowledge of hardship, and their pride, but they had no arms against this. People said the mal de peste came from the air. You just breathed it in, and then it was carried on the exhalations of the dying, which is why the nurses wound cloth around their faces. Mackenzie knew it was only a matter of time before it reached him and the other men. He returned to the goldfield. He knew how badly the digging had besmirched the land, how the forest had retreated with the trees felled for slabs and for firewood, leaving a desert of stones, earth, and detritus. But it was that time in the early evening when the sun was going down beyond the rim of the forest, and the earth's ugliness became almost invisible, and the men were clustered around bright fires, drinking grog or arak, singing familiar songs. Mackenzie found this camaraderie as consoling as anything he'd ever known. As he joined in the drinking and the singing, he wondered if this, a harmony of men's voices defying the poverty in which they existed, asserting that despite so many disappointments they still lived in hope, whether this might, after all, be defense enough against death. But he didn't know. The next day, one of the miners fell ill. He wasn't much older than a boy, a young fellow Jim Mackenzie knew as Billy, whose father had found gold in Otago and squandered it all on a failed manufactory of leather goods in Yorktown. Seeing this enterprise go down and faced then with his father's suicide, Billy lived with the conviction that, in a heartless world, joining a gold rush was as likely a way to make money as any other. But he told Mackenzie that when he found his gold, he wouldn't risk it on some futile endeavor, but rather exchange it at the Bank of Australia for enough silver dollars to last his lifetime. But Billy had got no gold, and now the fever laid him low. Mackenzie heard some of his compatriots explain to the boy that he would have to be moved to the large longhouse, where the sick belonged, or else risk infecting them all. But only Mackenzie had seen inside this place, and he balked at the idea of putting Billy in there. He told all his men to move to the last and smallest of the longhouses, the furthest away from the hospital. He helped them carry away their possessions, aware as he did so of how few chattels a gold miner can call his own. He then sent the diggers off for their day's labors, made Billy as comfortable as he could on his thin sleeping mat, and told him he would leave his side only to beg some medicine from the nurses in the hospital and return straight away. As he left, Billy cried out to him, "Don't let me die, Jim." Mackenzie scratched his red beard. "Do I look like a man who would?" he said. As soon as he left Billy's side, Mackenzie changed his mind. He began walking up the Savage Road to the Rajah's house. He'd seen it at a distance before, but never trespassed inside its gates, and now the whiteness and magnificence of it made him pause on the road. The day was fine, and he saw the sun shining upon great banks of lilies in the garden and heard the cassowaries chattering in the aviary. Mackenzie stared in wonderment. This was how great wealth always showed itself. It killed the poor with its beauty. And no men, Mackenzie reflected, are more susceptible to being wounded in this way than gold miners. Their day-to-day world is filthy and brutal, but their dreams are all of this luxurious life. They can imagine it without difficulty. They can envisage the fine clothes they would put on their backs, the polished silverware they would set out on their tables, pictures they would hang on their walls. This other life is present inside them all the time. Mackenzie made his way to the Rajah's door. A Malay servant dressed in impeccable white opened it a crack. He observed the miner's dirty moleskin trousers, his frayed shirt, his face that was hollow with hunger under the red beard, and informed him coldly that the Rajah would not deign to see him. But Mackenzie had been told since arriving at the mine that Sir Ralph Savage was a charitable man who tried to see the truth of things in the Sadong territories and to make things better for everybody under his jurisdiction, not only for himself. The Australian was gambling on this now, on this unlikely strain of charity to be found in a Rajah whose mind had been shaped by the self-serving hierarchies of the British Empire. Mackenzie stood his ground and told the servant he had come to make a bargain with the Rajah and that he must be heard. He was allowed into the hallway and told to wait there. He looked down at his dirty boots standing on the polished marble floor, and then his eye was caught by a many-branched candelabra placed on an ebony table. It stood about 2 feet high and appeared to be made of solid gold. It made Mackenzie feel dizzy to see this. He could not help but imagine it lying deep underground in the blue clay. He saw his pick breaking into the dark, compacted earth, and then his eyes, which had searched for so long and found nothing, staring in helpless disbelief as the first glint of it was revealed. This reverie was interrupted by the arrival of Sir Ralph. If he stood some way from Mackenzie, it was not so much that he was afraid of him, but because the stink of the miner's body made him wonder if this man was not already suffering from the fever. Wishing him to depart as soon as possible, the Raja asked him why he had come. He added that his servant had mentioned something about a bargain, but that as the ruler of the South Sadong territories, he was seldom forced into any kind of bargaining position. Though disinclined to make any show of deference to the Raja, Mackenzie forced himself to lower his head just a little as he said,
"You will appreciate, Sir Ralph, that I would not have come here knowing how unwelcome I and my compatriots are on your land unless it was with a proposition to put to you."
"Yes," said Sir Ralph.
"Speak up then and be on your way."
At this moment, Leon appeared. He stared disdainfully at Mackenzie, the very same ignorant gold prospector who had given him his painful black eye. Leon wore a jeweled dagger at his waist, and his hand now clutched the lapis lazuli handle. Mackenzie took this in, but didn't back away and continued with his proposition to the Raja.
"You see, Sir Ralph," he said, "one of my number has fallen ill. He's still almost a boy and cannot be allowed to die. But we have no medicine and no knowledge of the pest which has arrived on Borneo. If you will give me some antidote, something which will save Billy, then we will give up on the infernal mind and leave this island."
Sir Ralph looked searchingly at Mackenzie. Leon took the dagger out of its sheath and seemed to be measuring its sharpness against the palm of his left hand as he said,
"There is no antidote."
The Raja now feared that Leon's anger against this starving, anguished man would lead to a fatal end and decided he must hasten his departure before this happened.
"I can give you some Jesuit's bark," he said, "which seems to be effective against malaria, but the only cure for this fever rests in fate's hands. I don't lie to you. In the longhouses, there are nurses giving medicine to the sick. I've seen them, Raja. Why is that medicine being given if it will not cure?"
"It is arak, not medicine. It is arak mixed with a little water. It can deaden pain. But most of those who suffer in that house will die. And your friend Billy will die. Indeed, I suspect that you will all die now that the fever has entered the place where you sleep, unless you leave before tomorrow's sunset."
The cruelty of this last utterance was so unexpected that it brought into Mackenzie's heart a feeling of black despair. He stood there, all skin and bone inside his filthy clothes, watched by Leon's malevolent stare, and felt himself begin to break.
"We have nothing," he cried out. "We endured storms and sickness and thirst to get here, and all we find is barren earth. We live on the bodies of rats. I was told you were a compassionate man, Raja, but you show no pity."
"Why should he show pity?" said Leon. "You trespass on his land. You usurp buildings built by me as a hospital. You are despicable men."
"No, we are not despicable. Raja, sir, I appeal to you. We are simply poor. You of all people should be able to see the difference."
The Raja sighed.
"There are many people on my lands who are poor, but they do not behave as you have done, despoiling the earth, stealing what is not rightfully theirs. So you go back to your men and you warn them that they are all going to die unless they leave." "I promised," Mackenzie burst out. "I promised Billy I wouldn't let him die. Please give me something, Raja, something to give me hope."
"Hope of what?" said Sir Ralph.
"Give me that," Mackenzie shouted. He lunged forward with all the force his emaciated body could manage, grabbed the golden candelabra from the ebony table and held it high in the air, out of Sir Ralph's reach.
Leon raised his dagger, but Mackenzie scuttled fast for the door while the Raja laid a restraining hand on Leon's arm. That evening, the miners left the barren field for the last time and began to load their possessions into their boats. When these were in, they carried Billy to the door of the Longhouse Hospital, and the elderly woman with the strangely pigmented face was about to take him in when Mackenzie realized that this was Leon's mother and changed his mind.